Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the allegedly least corrupt country in the world. I don't understand, in a world run by criminal bankers, how such a thing could even exist, and if it did exist, how meaningless it would actually be at the end of the day. My very special guest today is a woman who has, who is quite humorous, but except it's only one bone of her body that manages to get that up. Other than that, she's a very, very sharp woman with incredibly serious information to have bestow upon us, if you will. Her name is Sophia Smallstorm, and she creates no small storm, mind you. Sophia, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure what all that meant that you just rattled off about me, but I'll just...
Assume that it's something really good and complimentary.
Right, I know. That's how... And why is it that everybody has a very special guest? It's never my special guest or my guest. It's always my very special guest.
Because if everybody was just a special guest, then it's not really that special. But if they're all a very special guest, then it is very special.
All right, well, I think we should vary the adjective. Extremely special guest. Actually, it's an ad.
In fact, we could do something else. We couldn't even use special, all right? We can even get rid of that word altogether. Our amazing, fabulous guest, Sophia Smallstorm, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, but if I flub the interview, then I won't be amazing. But anyway, that's the challenge. So you've implanted a little challenge in me. So
either that, or we've helped to build your confidence by knowing that you have a receptive host who actually is really receptive to your ideas and allow you to open up.
Hey, come on, you barely know me.
That's the whole idea.
Yes. So anyway, you know, shall we get into what I suggested right before you started recording?
Sure. We were talking about money, weren't we? The money game.
Yes. You were moaning a little bit about having some money or some problems that only money could solve. And I said, well, then you should play the money game. And so let me tell you how to play the money game. I read about it in a book. I don't know if anyone can buy this book anymore, by a man called David Cates, C-A-T-E-S. And the title was Unconditional Money. And it was actually sent to me by a literary agent that I once had. And I read this book. The first half was phenomenal. The second half was not so good. But I ended up ordering a lot of them. And I passed them around. Because from that book, I invented the money game. And he described something similar that he had done. But I took it a little beyond what David Cates wrote about. And so this is what it is, basically. And it changed my life. All right? So we're all ready for that. So what you do is, every day, you keep a mental note of the good things that happen to you. And they can be very innocuous. They can be very, you know, things that you wouldn't notice ordinarily, except maybe just in a millisecond, and say, that's nice. And you actually start paying yourself for these things. So I called this, at the time, I called it my spiritual money, right? So the way the spiritual money works is, you just go about your day, and let's say you have a great conversation with somebody. You pay yourself for that. You pay yourself whatever, $50, okay? And then at the end of the day, you'll write down, great conversation with so-and-so, $50. Let's say you're taking a walk and you see an absolutely lovely, I love calla lilies, and when I see them growing in people's front yards, I think they're just beautiful. So if I saw a calla lily growing, I would pay myself $10 or something like that. And you can just set a scale. I started with a modest scale. If I cooked myself an amazing soup and I ate it that night, I would pay myself maybe $20. If you have a premonitory thought and it actually comes true, you pay yourself for that. You might pay yourself a lot, $100 or $200, right? So at the end of the day, you sit down with your little notebook and you write down the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 things that you made a mental note of that day, and you put down a dollar value. This is your spiritual money. And you keep doing it for 1 month. And then you have to see at the end of the month if your spiritual money comes anywhere near your real money. And real money means it could be your salary, it could be anything, bits and pieces that, you know, if people, you know, sell things or they work freelance, as a lot of people do, they do odd jobs. You have to just see, what did you actually get in the way of checks and payments? How much did it add up to? And how far apart is it from your spiritual money? And I found, to my utter shock, that my spiritual money and my real money, the deposits into my checking account, were about $200 apart at the end of the month. And that was a very good month for me. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. They work very close. So I did it for a second month. And my friends, you know, I had been telling a few friends that I was playing this money game, and I was explaining to them, and they were pretty skeptical. So they were kind of interested that, because I was a freelancer at the time, that my spiritual money almost matched up to my real deposits. So I said, okay, I'm going to do it for a second month. And this time I'm going to just inflate. I'm going to lay it on. I'm not going to pay myself $20 for a good soup. I'll pay myself $50 or $60 or $70, right? So I just slapped on the spiritual money every day. I would write down large amounts, considerably larger than what I had paid the month before. And my friends were also interested again, and they were saying, well, so how's it going this month? And, you know, we were only into the second week of the month, and my spiritual money was piling up, but I really, because I was a freelancer and I worked two different kinds of freelance, I really hadn't gotten that much in checks. So I just told my friends, hey, you know, we're only at the middle of the month. There's not, you know, any need to worry yet. So I kept going, and I laid on the spiritual money. I paid myself handsomely for all kinds of things every day that were good. And the third week came, and my spiritual money was way beyond my actual deposit. So I was getting actually a little nervous myself, but not completely. And then I was at one of my freelance jobs. This was now into the third week of the month, and my desk phone rang, and it was my roommate. And he told me we had a horrible flood. The kitchen sink, a hose had broken, and there was an inch of water throughout the house. And I said, oh, so we called the flood control people, and they came and they ripped up the carpet and set up blowers, and I called my insurance company, and they came, and the adjuster was looking around my house, and she said, well, you have, you know, you're going to need a paint job. I said, why? She said, because look, you have this watermark on the bottom of the floor. I said, on the wall, you know, like an inch above the floor. I said, well, I could touch that up. She said, no, 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 you're going to need a paint job. And look, you have cracked tiles here. You're going to need tile replacement for the whole kitchen. And the list just went on and on. And I said to her, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to do all this. And she said, I don't care. She said, my job is, I'm an adjuster. I have to look at the damage and I have to evaluate it. And then I have to cut you a check. So I said, okay, but listen, I don't need a whole paint job. Just you can pay me for a can of paint and I'll touch up the bottom. She said, nope, I have to pay you for a paint job because you have contiguous walls. You have to paint your whole house. I said, oh my God, all right, do what you have to do. So do you know they issued me a check for $5,000. And together with my deposits, which were meager that month, that check and my spiritual money, again, matched pretty much. They were about $100 apart. And I could not believe it. And so what this taught me was that we have not learned to value things except in terms of money, and that I had actually trained myself to value the good things that happened to me on a daily basis. I had to train myself to first value them in money before I could really value them, period.
So that's kind of like the world's value to you rather than your value to the world, which is what people sell their labor for.
Right. I had to impose on myself the terms of the world in order to understand what value really was, because that's all I knew. And when I did this twice and I saw, you know, when I actually stretched the envelope and I saw again that it worked, I was starting to get scared. But it changed my consciousness around positivity, and I started to see my life and my days very, very differently. And all I can say is that was a very important lesson. And it continued to work for me in many ways, although I didn't play the money game per se. I'll tell you this. I had a friend. I taught a lot of my friends the money game, and they were all doing it, but they didn't necessarily do it the way I did it. Some people didn't finish the month, and some people did 1 month, and they didn't do a second. But I had a friend who decided to do it, and she did it seriously, and she called me one day, or I called her, and she said she had an argument with somebody. And because the argument was ugly, and she faulted herself for it, she felt that she pushed the argument beyond where it should have gone. So she said, I'm taking $500 away from my spiritual money. And I said, no, you can't take money away. You can't do that. That's not how it works. You just give yourself money, but you cannot take anything away for negative stuff. And she said, no, I was terrible to this person, and I shouldn't have said what I said, and I'm taking away $500. Well, do you know what happened to her?
Don't know.
She died.
Right. So, like, if you punish yourself monetarily for messing somebody around, you die if you're playing the money game, you know?
No, you have to. No, it's not. It doesn't boil down to that. She didn't die immediately, but she ended up dying. And I took that very seriously. You cannot take away from the positive that happens in your life.
Well, then it creates spiritual debt.
Right.
All right. And I think this is kind of what people get. What's that place called? Purgatory? Isn't that where people go until the end of time to suffer their spiritual debt, you know?
Well, if you believe in all that. But I think if you want to really retool your mind, look, the perps, the powers that be, when they need money, they simply run a printing press and they have more money. And we just look at a $20 bill or a $100 bill or our bank account, the total, and we freak out and we say, this is all I have. Well, listen, if for them all they have to do is print more, surely there should be an equivalent for us. And I think the whole fiat currency thing is a fraudulent way to live anyway, but we're kind of stuck in it because we're here and this is how it's done. But if you start valuing yourself and your daily life, I had to do it through that bridge. That's all I can say. I'm not happy that I had to start doing it with money, but I didn't, and it took me out of the money band, that value band. I left it. I never was there again.
I've got an interesting juxtaposition to this, because I wonder about money all the time, but only when I really, really need it. And sometimes when I'm not complaining about it, but just think about it, like get up in the morning, go to my computer, think about all the bills that I have to pay that day. I got the rent, the power, the fuel, the food. That's $500. I don't have $500. Log into my computer, into my PayPal, and guess what's in there?
$500.
From one guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I'll be sitting there at my desk at the end of a show, really, really hungry, and think, damn it, I need a meat pie. And then 2 seconds later, it's my mate Dan, and he's brought me a pie.
So how do you interpret that?
I interpret that but because I do a whole lot of good in my day's work, like I publish what people say that ordinarily don't get heard by the media and stuff, that I put a lot of chump change into my spiritual slush fund. And in so doing, whenever I do need something, what I want is more than I need, and I will always get exactly what I need, but I will never get what I want.
Well, maybe the word want is at fault then. I mean, I don't think the New Age is all stupid. I think some of the things they teach are actually very interesting.
But can I sum up the New Age movement in three sentences? You know the Lord Acton quote? Great power, what was it? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Now, that quote by itself sounds like a really good quote, doesn't it? Just like the New Age movement sounds really good. But there's a third line in that quote that actually makes the quote a hell of a lot more relevant, that normally doesn't get said to people or explained. All great men are inherently evil. So when you take any idea, and if somebody explains to you the good sides of it, but they leave out certain parts, like the responsibility element and the ability to influence the 3D world by acting within it, as well as your spiritual energy, and not trying to separate the two to make sure that your fate and your body and your mind are entwined, that's what it should be. But it's not. It becomes a detachment from reality for some people who choose to never look at things that scare them, because they believe that any kind of negativity, any kind of reality that they're not happy with, simply isn't worth listening to.
Right. They don't want to ruin their fine minds, like Barbara Bush said.
I saw a quote on Facebook today, something along the lines of, if I was less aware, I'd be more happy. And I think that maybe, just like I misuse the word want, people misuse the word happy. They think happiness is something other than what it is.
Well, they want it to be a permanent state, but a long time ago I came across the idea that our emotions are actually the vehicles or tools for our goals. In other words, you set certain goals, and if you are always negative and always angry and always in a funk, your emotions are really the power in you, of you, for you. When you're sailing and you're, you know, going strong, happy or whatever you want to call it, then you have a much better outlook and a better chance of making use of opportunities and drawing to you other opportunities. So I really think our emotions are the vehicle or path to the things that we quote-unquote want or want to create. I mean, I think ultimately we are creative. Actually, I shouldn't say ultimately. I should say foundationally, fundamentally, we're creative beings. We're creatures of intention and creation, but we've been reduced into creatures of reaction and response and fear because that part of us has become very dormant, the intention creation part. It's just a very fleeting thing in most of us now. And so all we do is sit here and, you know, experience the prods and pricks of the New World Order and all of the difficulties that it's constantly imposing on us. And we cry out and scream and rail and moan and twist and writhe, but we don't think that we could actually put intention out there and let it go. And I think the first thing is intention, the second thing is emotion. You really have to use your emotions as tools.
Well, your emotions are kind of like they can be a weapon, you know? I mean, you ever seen somebody get really angry and say something they don't mean and really, really hurt somebody?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think this is what has happened to society is somehow our emotions have become weaponized.
Well, yeah, because it's realized and recognized that our emotions are really very powerful creative tools. They're the second leg of creativity. And that is known. So it has been decided that fear should be the prevailing emotion in us and will never create.
Yeah. And that's one thing that psychopaths don't have, ladies and gentlemen, the ability to create from nothing.
Right. They mimic and they covet and they seek to take something that you started or that you made. And
then threaten you if you say, I actually started it and I made it and you were just there and you stole the idea off me, you scumbag.
Right. Because they have the legal system. That's another big game.
Which all react to protect each other like antibodies and white blood cells attack a virus. Anybody who tries to expose their industry or anybody within their industry that might lead to something else. Pew!
You know, when you said about looking in PayPal after you do a show and you think how many bills you have, well, I've had situations very much like that. I remember once I did not have enough money to pay the rent. And I was really scared. And I went to do it was in the winter, so I walk on the beach a lot because it's really stormy and blustery. And it was a gray day and really nice. I like those gray days with the wind blowing. And anyway, so I was scared of this whole financial reality and I decided to just take my walk. I said, I'm just going to take my walk. Is there anything right now, in the here and now? I mean, I don't have to pay the rent right now. It's not due until Monday. So is there anything that should ruin my walk? And the answer was no, just nothing. Everything is fine right now. So I took this walk and I actually ran into a guy who was an older man and he had a terrible accident with his knee. He was a track coach, and some kid had thrown the shot, you know, I guess you call it putting the shot, right into his knee, and it had shattered his knee. And so he could never run after that, and the best he could do was walk, and he had this terrible arthritis. And I listened to him. We walked 6 miles, and I listened to him the whole way, gave him some suggestions, and I realized I had actually been very supportive and he had probably benefited somewhat from this talk we had. Anyway, I got in my car after that, and I thought, oh, God, the rent, what am I going to do? Anyway, so I drove home, went to my mailbox, opened it, just, you know, with dread, because there are always bills. And amazingly, one of my freelance clients had paid me early. And they never paid early. In fact, the bookkeeper was somebody that I was sure had it in for me, because she made me wait weeks to get paid. And amazingly, here was this check sitting there. And it was early. And I had the money I needed.
It happens to me like on a daily basis. Like just today, for example, there's no food in the house at all. But you know where there is food? At the organic shop up the road. And you know how much they charge for a lunch? Exactly $5 New Zealand. How much money did I have in my wallet? $5 New Zealand. I got no other money at all. But I had enough for lunch. And guaranteed tonight at dinner, some kind of food is going to turn up or something of that nature. You know, it. I kind of like live on this. But the problem is when you're thinking about point B, but you're still at point A. It's when you think that you're in between, but you're really still at point A, that really, really kind of starts to generate anxiety, because you're reaching for something that you can't quite grasp yet. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like reaching out for your desires and not obtaining them forces you to live in a state of perpetual anxiety. And I think that's why television has put our desires out in front of us for all to see. All the beautiful girls, all the nice cars, all the great clothes. Everything. So desirable. And yet you'll never obtain it, will you? You'll never be able to reach out into that TV screen and pluck what's on there, will you? You'll listen to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, my very special guest. Oh my goodness! My absolutely fabulous guest!
Yes!
It's Sophia Smallstorm! And she's about as small a storm as Katrina. We'll be right back.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again. Now I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun.
Welcome back to the extravaganza, like Tony Danza, of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and my very spectacular, somewhat miraculous guest.
Oh, come on.
Is Sophia. I'm just laying it on.
Yeah, good. Thanks.
It's fun, isn't it? And
yeah.
And we were just telling you over the break about, you know, you've got the money game. Well, I have a rage problem, so I play the counting game if I'm stuck at a red light. I just estimate how long that light's going to take to go green for me or until the car starts moving. And almost every time now, that since I've started doing it, because I've got no radio in my car, I've got nothing to distract me, can't get the bastard to work. And almost every single time now, by the time I've counted to one, my car has started to move.
By just, itself?
No. And even on my way home now, I was just really impatient. I need to get home for the interview, but turns out I was a bit early. But I was stuck behind a slow driver, and I estimated 60 seconds. It's going to take me 60 seconds from here to get into my driveway. By the time I got down, counted down to one, I literally pulled onto my driveway. And I think I've actually been able to do this for quite some time. When I was in, I think I might have been 12, We went to go my dad's batch out in the Coromandel Beach, about 3 hours drive from where we are now. And we were over one side of the mountains. We had to get over the mountains to get to the beach. And my sister goes, okay, how long is it going to take? And without batting an eyelash, I said 79 minutes and set my watch counter. And again, the second it hit 79 minutes, we rolled onto the beach.
You are good. Hey, how long is it going to take to the end of the world?
I don't know. 28 weeks.
Don't say it. All right. I didn't want to put that thought out there, but, you know.
No, that was just a movie reference, actually, to the movie 28 Weeks Later.
Oh, yeah. I heard of that once. How about to the reversal of the New World Order? The waking up of humanity.
Well, to be honest, I can't actually take that in terms of a thing, because it's not like a distance. It's not like a mechanism. There's a lot of different things involved and a lot of unforeseen circumstance. What I do know is that the awakening and the dissolution of the New World Order is already happening. And so we don't need to wait. We just need to participate.
Yes. You can be part of the problem and you can sit in the matrix, or you can be part of the active, awake solution.
Which is, i.e., part of the problem for the guys in charge.
And yeah.
I don't know about you, but I actually love being part of the problem. If there's some kind of really nasty person doing some nasty thing, and I can just make his day just that little bit worse, it makes me feel good about myself. I don't know. Maybe that's sadistic, but I call it doing the right thing.
Well, I think there are differences in male and female attitudes and thoughts. I mean, this is a really... It's a male-dominated world, the activism world. You won't find that many women in it. I mean, you will. They'll be passing out information and doing the quiet advising and telling people what's going on. But it's very male-dominated otherwise, I have found.
Could I illustrate this?
Yeah.
Every month we have a little get-together at my house, you know, just to get a few activists and listeners and things like that just around to have a drink or not drink or whatever, and just have a conversation, more or less, right? And I basically have to twist people's arms to get them to bring women, because otherwise it's just my wife and me and a whole bunch of other guys, you know? Mm-hmm. And it really is absolutely fundamentally true. And the listening audience stats show it as well. The listening for talk radio is overwhelmingly women. Overwhelmingly male. The amount of talk show hosts, overwhelmingly male. It really is a man's game. At the end of the day, the successful female talk radio show hosts that I know that do it very, very regularly generally have very more baritone sort of voices as well. They're a bit deeper. And see? And it's the same thing with politics, activism, and things of that nature. What is this phenomenon, do you think, Sophia? In fact, if you'll give me a second while you try to explain it, a guy called Dr. Sam Shea, in fact, had a slide on this. I'm just going to quickly find it for us. So why do you think this this whole activism scene is so male-dominated?
Well, I was just told this weekend by someone about something called aromatase, and I haven't looked it up. Every fat cell has aromatase in it, but I did get far enough in my research this morning to learn that fat is all part of the endocrine system. So it appears that fat will work very hard at converting testosterone into estrogen. And a fat man a very fat man can have more estrogen in his body than a woman because he has that many fat cells and they all have this aromatase in them. So I was doing some thinking, and I'm going to research this more over the next few days, but this guy that was telling me all this told me that testosterone makes you happy. It makes you confident. And the fatter you are as a male, the less confident you are, the more your muscles will atrophy. You'll actually have what looks like little breasts. You'll be giggly, bald, all kinds of stuff that really is about feminization. And so the males who have kept their testosterone going, and I think, you know, it's almost like exercising. If you use a muscle, then it continues to be strong. So I think that it takes some testosterone to do this activism on in a public way. And one thing that I...
I so have to interject here. I'm very sorry, Sophia. You're going to need to hold that thought. Because I found the slide and it really fits in exactly what you're saying here. This is left brain versus right brain. Left equals male, right equals female. Now, here's the traits of the male. Testosterone, whereas the female's got estrogen. Male uses logic, whereas female uses feeling. Male takes action, whereas a female is prone to thinking. A male is detail-oriented, whereas a female is big-picture-oriented. With a man, facts rule, with a female, imagination rules. With man, words and language. With women, it's symbols and images. With man, the stronger brain connection to rest and digest, or parasympathetics. And for a woman, the stronger brain connection to fight or flight, or sympathetics. Now, just think about those male attributes in terms of activism, in terms of talk radio. There's testosterone, logic, action, details, facts, words, language, stronger brain connection, you know?
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense.
And then have a look at what would you say is a very female-oriented field of work, like, say, teaching, for example. Lots of female teachers that's using feeling, thinking, big picture, imagination, symbols and images.
Well, females are noted for nurturing. They have greater nurturing tendencies than men, and men have more sexualization and aggression than females do. So that's really where the split is. Now, I'll tell you something very interesting, and I've seen this play out. If you put your hand in front of you and you look at it, and I'm not the palm, the other side, the back, and you compare the length of your index finger and your ring finger, the traditional male hand, heterosexual male hand, will have a longer ring finger and a shorter index finger. And the traditional female hand, heterosexual female, will have a longer index finger compared to the ring finger. And interestingly, gay women and gay men will have the hand of the other sex. So the length of the ring finger is a marker of how much testosterone you have in your system.
So are you saying homosexuality isn't a choice? It's just the hand that they were dealt?
Ha ha, yes. I have the typically male hand. I have a much longer ring finger than index finger. And I'm not gay or lesbian, but I am athletic. So it appears that athletic females tend to have the longer, they have the male hand. And all my life, when I was younger, I would look at my hand and think, why is there such a difference between my ring finger and my index finger? It's a quarter of an inch. And I'd look at other people's hands. I'd look at in magazines and pictures of women's hands, and they all had this long index finger. And I think it boils down to grip strength. You need a long ring finger to complete the power in the grip. And I used to be a good tennis and racket sport player because you can grip the racket all that much better if you have this long ring finger. It gives you strength in the bottom of your grip because you have this weak pinky otherwise. So anyway, I thought this is very interesting, and I've looked at people's hands, and increasingly with this feminization of men, and this is what Professor Daryl Hamamoto has brought to my attention, the complete change of the biology of males in today's world. He has encountered young adult males who weep and tell him and cry that they are not gay, they're not straight, they don't know what they are, they don't have any sex drive, there's something in between that they are, and they don't know what it is. And there's a very, very concerted effort to create half-baked males, to bring them toward the feminine, away from the masculine. And I'll tell you what I have researched that I think explains this, but you were about to say something.
I once asked Dr. Catherine Albrecht, is there anything she sometimes thinks about but she never mentions on radio because it's too controversial? Mm-hmm. And she said, pharmaceutical drugs that turn people gay.
Well, I don't know about those.
It was incredible. She started laying out these articles and things like that of these guys who had taken like three, four times their dose or something like that, and then gone and had a homosexual escapade, and then like eloped to New York or something out of Connecticut, and then woken up like a couple of days later wondering what the heck was going on.
Really?
Just amazing stuff.
Well, I'll tell you this. I did some reading about conception, and you're familiar with the idea that we have xenoestrogens in our plastics, right? Plastics, the phthalates and the BPA, they're all estrogen mimickers.
Bisophenylalanines and all the inks. When I go through and I buy anything at a shop that's got like those printed receipts, I tell them, you know, try to not touch the ink, man. It'll give you breast cancer or give you, you know, man boobies.
Right. It's not even just the ink. It's the coating. It's a bisphenol A brominated plastic coating that makes those receipts shiny. Hmm. And that's that. I was at a grocery store once, Trader Joe's, and there were six checkers standing there. They were all male, all bald, all in their 30s or 20s. And they were all handling these receipts all day. And I said to my guy who was ringing me up, I said, don't touch that thing. I'll take it. And he said, why? I said, because it's feminizing you. I said, just turn around. Look at all your buddies. Nobody has any hair. How old are you all? And he didn't know this, and he was a little shocked. But anyway, so here's what happens. Every baby upon conception, whether the sperm carries an X chromosome or a Y chromosome, determines the sex of that baby, right? So the human embryo is either XX, it's going to be a girl, because the sperm that came in was an X chromosome sperm, or it's going to be a boy, in which case it's XY, because the sperm that came in and penetrated, the first to win the race, was a Y carrying sperm. So all embryos are female for the first 6 weeks of pregnancy. And then it's the job of the Y chromosome to pull out of that original initial female form what makes a male. So in the seventh week of pregnancy, the little male gonads and reproductive organs start to form, and the male brain starts to develop. But if, this is my contention, if the environment in the womb is not right, if it's imperfect, if it's off, then that completion, which occurs from the seventh week to the 39th to 44th week of pregnancy, that completion doesn't take place. And what's happening today is the rate of male miscarriage, boy babies being miscarried, is huge. And the rate of boy babies, you know, basically they're dying in the womb. when they don't, when they're miscarried. The body is rejecting, saying, this isn't going to work. We have to stop and we have to start again some other time. Then you also have a very high incidence of hermaphrodite babies being born, which have the genitals of both sexes. So this strikes me as being, again, an incomplete job. The Y chromosome cannot pull a male fully out of that initial female form. Or you get homosexuals, and which our rates of homosexuality incidence is much, much higher now than it ever was. And it's very possible that these are incomplete males. They're males with female brains, males with female tendencies, males that haven't fully developed because that internal environment wasn't quite right. And so I explain the internal environment. Let's say the mother is full of phthalates and xenoestrogens. She's been, you know, using plastics, and lots of these personal care products have phthalates in them. The shampoos that make your hair all shiny, they have plasticizers. And we use all kinds of soft plastics and hard plastics, and they all are estrogen mimickers. So let's say the female, the mother's bloodstream is full of these chemicals, and that's where the baby is getting its nourishment. So it's getting a lot of influence, and it's not able to become a full male. So anyway, that to me explains this professor's, you know, his anecdotes about the students that he has encountered who are very upset because they don't know what they are.
Do you believe that there's an element within society that is deliberately doing this? And if so, what's their end game? Why?
Well, it's all toward the post-human society. The element, as you refer to it, wants to stop, break down the nuclear family, because that's the tightest ring in the chain. And they've already succeeded in doing that with divorce, and, you know, television has been a tremendous intrusion into our lives, and then all the trends, the marketing, the hypersexualization of everybody. Anyway, the friction between men and women in general. But to feminize the men is a very important thing in this plan, because it takes that aggressive nature way, way, way down. And you're not going to get a lot of resistance from men who are female.
Hold on a second. I remember that there was some kind of Indian village or something in America when all the men went out during the day and the cavalrymen rolled in and they killed all the women and children because there were no real men around to defend them.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about? They're trying to do that on sort of like a society-wide level, so it's kind of like all the men have left the village and leaving everybody vulnerable?
Yeah, if they turn the men into women, then they don't have the male defense. They don't have the male resistance in the society. And I learned only this weekend about this, I forgot what it's called, aromatase, that fat cells have aromatase in them, and the job of aromatase is to convert testosterone into estrogen. That was new for me. So, you know, I'm only telling you what somebody told me, but he's very, very thorough. He does a lot of research, and I think he probably knows his stuff. I have to keep going. I studied fat today, and I learned about brown fat and white fat and visceral fat and subcutaneous fat and all this other stuff. But I understood from my preliminary research that fat is part of the endocrine system. It was never viewed as such, but it is. It's a hormonal component.
Might be part of the reason why a whole bunch of cannabis cells actually get stored up in the fat or something like that, because it's used as a nutrient or something. There's a cannabinoid molecule that can morph into certain different types of, it can basically mimic nutrients, different types of nutrients, and your cells have receptors in them that send signals out to the cannabinoid molecules and tell them what kind of nutrients it requires, and the molecule morphs into them. Yeah, it's endocannabinoids, I think. It was Dr. Bob Malamed, who's doing a lot of tours of major U.S. universities as well at the minute. He's a big advocate of Rick Simpson's work, who's developed the high-potency THC hemp oil, which you can apply to, say, skin cancers. This is how he found out about it in the first place, just applying it, the oil to a skin cancer on his nose. And after a while, the skin cancer came off, and he went to the doctor, and they told him he was cured. So he started doing it to a whole lot of other people, and he found out he can cure pretty much anything.
All right.
Yeah. PhoenixTears.ca, very interesting stuff. Anyway, we're coming very much to the lesser end of the broadcast now. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience, Sophia? Perhaps something, you know, you've never shared before, or don't talk about it because it's even more controversial, you know?
Now you just stalled me completely. It was such a huge open question. I can talk about things all the time, and there are lots of things I've never talked about on the air. I never talked about the money game on the air. Maybe people think it's stupid, but nice thing about you is that you're a very flexible host, just as you said you were.
I am the gymnast of talk radio.
That's nice. I like that because I don't have to cite a whole bunch of, you know, science. Although I did a little bit tonight.
Well, see, that stuff's good. Sometimes the general idea is more valuable than the details.
Right. It's the concepts that we have to start putting together, and we have to start refitting them in new and creative ways. We have to realize that we're a lot more potent than we think we are. We're not weak and full of estrogen and quiet.
I feel like I am kind of at some point turning into some form of wussy, you know, in a little bit of a kind of way. But you know how I balance that out? By going out to protest and yelling angrily through a megaphone for several hours. That gets your testosterone and your adrenaline up.
Well, sure, because you're participating in a real life public. It can work you really up, really work you up. I went to protests when they had the whole Iraq war thing, and I remember marching with the crowd and thinking, this is amazing. I would never do such things otherwise. But yeah, the crowd energy, it's very uplifting.
It is, especially when you're making them laugh with really terrible jokes through a megaphone that, for some reason, because they're said through a megaphone, they're no longer terrible jokes and the crowd actually laughs. I don't understand the mechanism here, but it works somehow. It's really fun. It really is.
I think it's your personality. I think you just have a knack for this. You were born to do this.
Well, I was kind of born to entertain, you know. I was just thinking about this. I saw a interview that George Carlin did, and he said when he was a boy, he wanted to be like a radio disc jockey. He wanted to be a talk radio show host. He wanted to be a performer. He wanted to be an actor or something. And he realized later in life, when he was about 40 or 50, that when he was a boy, everything he wanted to do was to be in front of other people and entertain them. And he became a stand-up comedian and been in a few acting roles and things like that. And that's... it's funny that he mentioned that, because that's exactly how I felt as a boy and still feel now. And I'm merely just acting out my boyhood fantasy, and by God, when your fantasy becomes reality, does reality no longer suck? Because you're no longer denying your true self.
Right, you're doing your dharma.
Or my Greg. We'll be right... speaking of which, Sophia, do you have any websites or things of that nature you'd like to plug before we go?
AboutTheSky.com. My store is AvatarProducts.com. I really want people to pay attention to wireless exposure. Maybe I'll do a show with you on that sometime, because I have some different ways of putting it.
That'd be cool.
Yeah? You want to? Okay.
Sure. All right. We will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, probably after the break, with Suzanne Posel. Catch you again. Thank you, Sophia. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Hour number two with my fabulous, somewhat unexpected, extraordinary, 60 minutes worthy, frickin' daily show. Should have interviewed her, but unfortunately, it's only a daily show. Suzanne Posel from OccupyCorporatism.com. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Damn good with the introductions. Like, can you tell me a little bit about what you've been up to recently?
Exposing scumbaggery, breaking news stories, exposing charlatans in the CBD industry and medical marijuana industry.
In a funny looking way, or just in a general kind of way?
In a oh my god, they're freaking out kind of way.
Elaborate.
I wrote last month about the International Cannabidiol Organization of Manufacturers and Research, ICAMAR.
A cannabidiol, is that the one where you like just pick up the phone and they deliver cannabis to your residents?
Who doesn't wish for that? But
well, this, you know, in New Zealand we've got taxis that do it. They call it quality cab.
They do. Oh my god, that's not happening here.
No, it's not happening here either. I was just making it up.
Oh, too bad.
Look, you can say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
Yep. Well, this group is a watchdog group, and what they do is they use independent laboratories to test products. One of the products that they've recently tested was Ultra CBD. Ultra CBD claims to have 200 milligrams in their product supplement of CBD. However, with an independent laboratory test done by Iron Labs, with two products, one that was sent directly from Ultra CBD and one that they purchased online as a secret shopper. And the conclusion that ICAMAR got from the laboratory test from the first that was purchased directly out of retail showed that it doesn't contain 200 milligrams of CBD, it contains 26.52 milligrams of CBD. So you're spending $40 and you're getting a fraction of what you should be getting as far as cannabidiol content. The sample that was provided directly from Ultra CBD was also tested and it showed that it contained 9.78 milligrams of cannabidiol in a 30 to 32 milliliter bottle. So think about that. You've got $2.80 worth of cannabidiol, and you're spending $40.
Have you heard of food package inflation? You know how, like,
no.
they make a can slightly skinnier or slightly taller or something like that, and then reduce the amount that's actually inside it, so it sort of looks the same size, but there's actually less stuff in it, and they sell it to you for the same price?
What we have here is a situation where they have a tiny fraction of what they're claiming. Like I said, $2.80 worth of CBD. And in one test, 26 milligrams. And then in the test directly from Ultra CBD, 9.78. That is ridiculous. So this article I wrote...
Let me guess. They're afraid that if they actually give people the full strength, it'll actually perform stuff that's ridiculously good for them, and word will spread, and people will stop the massive pharmaceutical drug market cartel's hold on Americans' health.
Let me put it to you this way.
That's just a total stab in the dark here. I'm sorry.
No, you're not that far off. It's not a total stab in the dark. Alan Frankel, who is a medical doctor in California and a huge supporter of the use of CBD and one of the founders of the movement, one of the people who actually got medical marijuana an issue, got everything together several decades ago and actually made it the what it is today. Here's what he said when he was asked about Dixie Dewdrops, Dixie X Dewdrops, who repeatedly in independent laboratory tests test lower CBD content than what they claim. And here's his response. For some people, taking 1 or 2 milligrams of CBD a day has a positive effect. And since they're used to and they respond to lower doses, it's not a big deal that these companies are selling product with lower doses. However, Dixie X Dewdrops claims to have 100 milligrams of CBD, and they don't. They have, again, a fraction of what should be in there. It only contains 45 milligrams of CBD, not 100. So in order to explain this away, one of the founders of the movement says, oh, well, you know, people respond to low doses, so that's why we give them low doses. Then why don't you say it only has 45 milligrams of CBD instead of claiming 100?
So if I said to somebody, look, I know you respond well to thinking that you own gold, so I'm going to sell you this gold bar, which is actually gold wrapped around a tungsten bar, which has about the same weight. And you're going to think that you've got a whole thing of gold there. There's nothing wrong with that, is there? Especially if you pay me the exact amount that an entire gold bar would cost. Right?
That is exactly what's happening here.
You know, because you still feel good. Oh, I got something that looks like a gold bar. Mm-hmm.
Well, think about how much of the product you'd have to take to get to what they claim it is. You'd have to purchase more and more of it.
Well, the doctors out there prescribing, I want you to do 200 milligrams, you know. Or is there like some people injecting this into people's arms and stuff? He needs 200 milligrams of CBD stat. His eyes falling out of his head.
Oh, let's move on to doctors. Because, you know, the idea is the doctor shows up in the lab coat with the stethoscope around their neck and then, you know, that's an authority figure, right?
If you say so.
Well, people think that when they see a doctor, you know, 4 out of 5 doctors recommend this toothpaste, even though it's riddled with fluoride. But
I don't know, because like 4 out of 5 doctors are douchebags.
I don't go to 2 medical doctors tried to kill me with both of my children. I'm done with them.
I once heard that 9 out of 10 people enjoy gang rape. Doesn't make it true.
Whoever said that is an idiot. Well, there's a company called Doctors Trusted, and they are, quote, and this is on their website, okay, folks, I'm not making this up, I can't make this up. They are a consumer protection organization that, quote, consists of seasoned entrepreneurs, qualified doctors, and experienced marketers working together to make the internet safer for consumers buying health and fitness products. I didn't stutter. It's a group of doctors, entrepreneurs, and marketing people. What does this have to do with making sure that your product is safe? Because by their own admission, they are a group of people whose interest it is to sell products. So what Doctors Trusted does, and a lot of CBD and medical marijuana websites are selling you products, they use Doctors Trusted. In fact, Hemp Meds PX, which is one of the biggest, uses Doctors Trusted. And when I'm done explaining to you what this charlatan organization does, you'll realize that this is all just a joke to get you to think that because a doctor's face is on there and a doctor wrote a review, that the product is what it says it is and that it's safe.
very similar to those Harvard studies where they just tested people who were in front of a Harvard, you know, authority figure. Hey, electrocute this guy to death. All right. Yeah,
exactly. Because we think that when we see a doctor, there's a semblance of authority. They're using that age-old tactic to market to you. And so Doctors Trusted, their goal is to, quote, create a safer environment online for online shopping, allowing customers to decide quickly whether a website meets acceptable safety standards, whether the website, not the products on the website itself. They look at the website to make sure that it's claiming things that are not in conflict with the with what the FDA says here in the United States. And they just look at the website and make sure that it is not violating rules and regulations of the FDA. They do not, by their own admission, they do not test, and I'll quote them, we do not test the advertised products for potency. Yet they intimate in their reviews that these items are what they say they are and that they're safe. In fact, one doctor who works for them is Dr. Daniel Hanley. He endorsed Ultra CBD, the company I was talking about earlier, that sells the product that claims to have 200 milligrams. In one test came out 26 milligrams, and another test came out 9 milligrams. So what Doctors Trusted, Dr. Hanley wrote in his review of Ultra CBD was that the website was, quote, trustworthy and safe for consumers to purchase products at the time of the review.
That sounds an awful lot like the standard line for fluoride. Oh, it's safe, it's effective, it's safe, it's effective. How many times do we need to repeat it? It's safe and effective.
But they don't test the advertised products for potency, so how can he say that it's trustworthy and safe? He's
incidentally,
not tested.
Incidentally, they don't test fluoride levels in New Zealand water or people's urine, or we've never done a study to justify it either.
Exactly, and we've got a product here, folks, that is amazing. The U.S. government has been testing cannabidiol since 1940, and they finally patented it in 2003. This has been shown to tell cancer cells to turn off and to tell other cells not to bring them food or care for them or even hang out with them, and then you expel it naturally. This chemical, we have receptors for it in our brain and in 7 other points in our body, on organs in our body. And that is how we are made. We are made to take this in. Animals as well, because most of the studies are done on animals before humans, and animals have these receptors as well. So think about that too. If you have a dog or a cat who's sick, you might not have to take them to the vet and get them the therapy that's being offered by the doctor who is being paid by a pharmaceutical company to administer to your pet. You can give them cannabidiol, and they will get healthy. This stuff works on arthritis. It works on inflammation. It breaks the blood-brain barrier. So it's been shown to alleviate symptoms of depression. In fact, the National Institutes of Health is getting together and doing a study in 2015 on AIDS patients. Okay, when MH17 went down and everybody was like, oh no, maybe the cure for AIDS died on that plane. We already have a potential cure for AIDS. And the government in the United States will be testing to see if that is a viable cure starting next year. So, you know, don't worry about that garbage. But we have this that is available now. And as far as the FDA is concerned, it's a food ingredient. So it's not regulated. Now, I'm not a fan of the FDA, but this is an unregulated industry. And here's what happens when you have unregulated products. You have people who sell you products who don't contain the amount that they say it does. So you're not going to get the effects that they claim you're going to get, because you'd have to take triple, quadruple, or more of the product in order to at least get what they're claiming.
And of course, you can't afford that.
Who can? Because the cheapest thing that Canaway sells right now is the Canaway Chew, which is the gum. And you have to understand that with CBD, the best way to take it is orally.
I think
preferably.
who can afford it? I think U.S. Standard Oil employees could afford it, you know, shareholders perhaps.
Well, the Canaway Chew is $249 for a month's supply. And that's the cheapest thing that they sell.
You know, they could have just made it $420 and it would have been way more awesome than that.
It is ridiculous. There's a company called Hookahs, and they are selling, their marketing strategy is that it's cool and it's hip and it's sexy.
Because we're hookahs.
Exactly, because the hookahs, and they've got, the products are incredibly marketed. It looks like that Monster Energy drink, you know, it's got like really cool graphics and
I can just like imagine throwback. I can just imagine myself chasing the CEO down the street. Bitch, where my money? Where my money?
I got to tell you this, and I got to get back to Doctors Trusted for just a second and Dr. Hanley. Because when I looked up this guy, and I wanted to find out who this guy is, because he's not testing the products, and he's claiming that they're safe, and he's claiming that everything's cool. And this is just not what's happening. And so he's putting his name behind this. Why would he put his name and his license? He's a medical doctor. He actually is a medical doctor. He is a medical doctor for hire. His reviews cost anywhere between, and I'm not kidding you, between $100 and $6,875 is the highest that I found he's been paid for a review.
So does he take his clothes off during this? Is it a live mail review?
No. He just says your website is compliant with the FDA, but he says it in a way that makes it sound like your products are safe and efficient and what they claim to be. And
it's like a ghostwriter for the pharmaceutical industry.
Except he's working for the CBD industry and the medical marijuana industry.
You know,
HempMeds PX, which is one of the biggest names out there, is certified not only by Doctors Trusted, but also by Dr. Hanley, who also certified Ultra CBD.
Well, and he's probably able to do that because he is certifiable.
It's ridiculous. You see his name when you go to Cibidex, when you go to Canchu, when you go to HempMeds PX, when you go to Ultra CBD. He's the doctor that they paid to review. Like, it's ridiculous. Wouldn't they think that, hey, we're all in the same industry, we're all pulling the same wool over their eyes, let's get a different doctor? No, they don't do that.
These guys are practically like a chorus line.
That's how stupid that they think we are. And unfortunately, folks, they're not that far off. Because we're not paying attention. We're so enamored with the idea that we have medical marijuana. We're so enamored with the idea that we have CBD and we can purchase it and we can do this now. And in some states, it's legal. And in some states, it's even more legal. And in some states, you've got at least the medical marijuana part legal in a sense. We're not paying attention to the corporations that are coming up. They're for profit, folks. They're not here to help you. Okay? They don't care about whether or not you get healthy. They care about whether or not you buy their product. And their job is to make their product look better than everybody else's product, more hip, more fun, more sexy, more accessible. They put Dr. Hanley up there if you need a medical doctor's review of it to say that it's safe. They've hit all the corners in order to get you to market to you, to get you to buy this product.
I just fail to see how they can make Dr. Hanley sexy and with the product and stuff and the juxtaposition what do they have him wearing? Some kind of like a marijuana bush bikini on?
No, this is the Hookah's line of products. They sell it as like a vaporizer. And so the container that it comes in, and you have to keep purchasing these containers. You can buy one with like a skull and crossbones, and it's all flowery, like a tattoo artist would do, or something from Betty Page, or you know, throwing back to different genres of people, so that they'll find it hip and cool. It's like when McDonald's started doing that "loving it" commercials, and then all of a sudden, like these really cute 20-something-year-olds were having a good time eating McDonald's food, which never happens.
Well, because it's only
like,
got.
Oh, I look hip. I look cool. I could eat McDonald's too.
It's very difficult to feel hip and cool when you're eating 15% real beef.
Or, listen, folks, their version of beef isn't always beef, okay? Because it's 100% beef at Burger King, except it's not beef, it's horse. The 100% beef at Taco Bell is not cow. It's not bovine, like you would assume when you see the word beef. It's horse. So, I don't know. I'm not saying that we shouldn't eat horses. I'm not saying that we should. I would like to know that my burrito won the Kentucky Derby instead of won the first prize at the state fair.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, you can go out to somebody in Taco Bell. Is there a horse in this taco? And they go, no! I can't help it. I've been waiting to say that joke all day at the right time.
It was
actually originally a Robin Williams joke on his sketch Weapons of Self-Destruction. He was talking about how Arnold was like really, really strong and stuff way back in the day. And he asked him, you know, Arnold, are you taking horse hormones? And he's like, no!
Oh, man.
Did I just make you lose your train of thought? I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, I saw this video that Adam Kokesh did, and you know I'm not a fan of Adam Kokesh, but it was a very compelling video about how Robin Williams may have passed away, and I really hope that that's not true because, man, that's horrible. It's horrible. Go watch the video. That's all I'm going to say.
If you want to know how much of a tragedy Robin Williams' death really is for America, watch his film Man of the Year, where he plays a comedian that wins the U.S. presidency.
I grew up. I think one of the first movies I ever saw him do was Popeye, and I was a little kid.
I did not know he was in Popeye. I didn't even know there was a Popeye movie. I thought it was just a cartoon.
No, there's a Popeye movie. He did that with not Shelley Long, woman who was in The Shining.
I guess I'm just that's Duvall.
Duvall, yeah.
Shelley Duvall.
She played Olive Oil.
Yeah. Shelley Duvall.
Shelley Duvall.
You can't make this stuff up.
They did a really
good
job of bringing it to life. They did a really good job. It didn't look campy at all. But then again, it was in the 80s, so everything was campy. But yeah, that's all I'm going to say about that. Go watch the video. It's really compelling. There's no way to verify that, but if it's true, oh dear God, you know.
Yeah. Well, was he actually even alleging that?
That it was autoerotic asphyxiation.
What, he was doing it to himself, huh?
That there's a movement, I don't know, there's a fetish to cause yourself to asphyxiate, and then that's somehow pleasurable.
Yeah, choking while shagging. Yeah.
Well, but like with like how he was found, with a belt around your neck, a plastic bag.
Ugh. That actually starts to make a real sick feeling in the pit of your stomach right away, doesn't it?
It made me, yeah, because Kokesh played the initial report from the police, which they gave all the details. And he described what could have been an accident with autoerotic asphyxiation. And there's no way to prove that. I'm not saying that that happened. I'm not saying that I know anything. But it's a very compelling video. And it's bothered me ever since I watched that video. Because there's no way I could prove that. I wouldn't even bother looking into it. But if that's what happened, I mean, that's a horrible accident. And to discover that. Must be terrible for the person who discovered that, if that's true. because then you've got this scene and you're, the first thing you think is, oh my God, this is Robin Williams. This is not how he can go down. See, people don't realize Robin Williams is going to be coming out in about four or five movies over the next 12 months. And I think several of them are kids' movies. So there's no way on this earth that it could come out if that's how he died, that that's how he died, because that would kill all the movie sales and all this money that they've put into making these films that are going to be coming out, unknowing, you know, not knowing that he was going to pass away.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes when you're doing something naughty, there's a little part of your brain that goes, if you die right now, this is how they're going to tell your mother they found you. Don't do
and
it,
if
folks.
If you're famous, this is how they're going to tell the world.
Don't choke your chicken, literally, folks. It's not worth it. I just really made something quite bad there, didn't I? I'm sorry.
Because it's so personal.
Conveniently, we're going to break. We'll be right back.
Every breath we take together.
Oh, passion, you prey on us when we sleep. Oh, passion, you chase after the tired or the weak. Oh, passion, you know you mean only harm. Oh, passion, you reach out with your long arm. But oh, passion, I won't let you near me. Ah, no. Oppression, you shall learn to fear me. Yes, you will.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Now, the final segment on the Vinnie Eastwood Show with the magnanimous, the glorious, the historious with Pistorius. I don't even know what the hell Pistorius is. I think it was some kind of South African dude who killed his wife. Suzanne Posel, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's kind of freaking random. OccupyCorporatism.com is the website, as well as the USIndependent.com. Okay, now there's a couple of elements I wanted to really expand on with you. I mean, the political landscape actually is one thing that's really starting to irk on me, considering it's like election time here in New Zealand, right? And I was just remembering during the last US election when Barack Obama got elected for a second term, and it was like live on the radio, and the election results had come in. Barack Obama won, as I thought he probably would, much to my dismay, of course. It's not like the other guy would have been any better. And I just decided, you know, this whole process is really stressful. It's really disempowering. So it's time to get drunk, right? Shot of tequila on the air. Anybody else out there, you know, you're getting over the election, have a shot with me, I said. And just recently, dude Nicky Hager, who I've had on the show before, haven't been able to get on since, but he wrote a book called Dirty Politics, and in it, it details a lot of really nasty little stuff going on inside the US political scheme, and guess where they learned all their dirty tricks? The US Republican Party. Yeah. And apparently, everybody knew this already, and because several books had come out before Dirty Politics by authors like Ian Wishart, who's just got his new book out, Totalitaria, and Ben Vigen, who wrote State Secrets, and who's bringing out a new book soon as well. These guys have already exposed all this kind of dirty stuff, right? But the thing is, they pushed the envelope, and I think this is the real problem inherent, Suzanne, in any kind of reporting, any kind of exposure of scumbaggery. If you tell people 1% of the truth, they'll keep listening to you. They'll love you forever. Tell them 100% of the truth, they never want to listen to you again.
Yes, actually something similar to what you're talking about came out. We heard about William Thompson. I'm sure you heard about it too, and Brian Hooker, who came out with the CDC and whistleblowing about these autism studies on the MMR vaccine, where information concerning African-American boys was suppressed and their susceptibility after receiving the MMR vaccine to developing autism. That information was cut out. And William Thompson has done several studies with the CDC and currently works at the CDC. And as this was coming out and everything was coming out around it, there was one gentleman, I won't mention his name, but when I talk about this, you'll probably remember. This one gentleman started writing a lot of articles about the whistleblower, about William Thompson. Originally, there was a YouTube video where a private conversation was put up by Brian Hooker with William Thompson, and they were discussing the parts of the studies concerning African-American boys that was taken out. This one reporter, who is a 30-year veteran, independent investigative journalist, written several books, very, very respected in alternative circles, wrote some articles concerning an anonymous source that he had. And the information that he was putting out was absolutely bogus. It was so bogus that when William Thompson put out his formal response to Brian Hooker putting out the private conversation on YouTube, he actually added in a response to this independent journalist calling out that this information is not true. And let me just read you a quote from the media journalist, and here it is. Quote, William W. Thompson, PhD, the CDC whistleblower, was escorted off the premises of the CDC campus yesterday afternoon. This is what a source told me. Therefore, the CDC knows Thompson is the whistleblower and he's in danger, end quote. Now, in Thompson's response to Brian Hooker and his formal response to the fact that he is the CDC whistleblower, he wrote this, quote, my colleagues and supervisors at the CDC have been entirely professional during this entire matter, or since this entire matter became public. In fact, I received a performance-based award after the story came out. I've experienced no pressure or retaliation and was certainly not escorted from the building, as some have stated. Now, I talk about this a lot because there seems to be this exception to the rule. When the mainstream media talks about their anonymous sources and sources say and people's opinions are, we say, oh, that's bogus. The source doesn't exist. But when example of how when you claim anonymous sources, you absolve yourself from any responsibility and then put out absolute garbage that is not true, that muddies up the water. Because we have a gentleman, two gentlemen who came out on the same issue who are saying something absolutely true. The CDC has been caught several times, and I've written articles over the years about their suppression of information concerning vaccines, thimerosal, and autism, including a study that was conducted in the 1990s and then finally published in 2010, where rice monkeys were given MMR vaccines with and without thimerosal. The ones who did not receive the thimerosal did not develop any autism spectrum disorder behaviors or symptoms, but every single one of the rice monkeys that got the thimerosal all came down with autism spectrum disorder behaviors and symptoms. Okay, so there you go. Now, there's been more studies, and I quoted a lot of them in my article to give people an idea that this information has been out there, and the whistleblower is not blowing a whistle that we don't already know, but this is a recent study where this information about African-American boys was stricken from the publication before it went to print, and these two gentlemen know that that's true. And so that in itself is enough. That's enough sensationalism, folks. We don't need journalists in independent or alternative media putting out garbage, lies, claiming that a source told them that, when it's just not true. If you have someone saying anonymous sources, be skeptical of that. I'm a journalist. I get people giving me information all the time. If they can't give me the direct source, I'm not going to cover it. I'm sorry, folks, but a real whistleblower will come forward. In the United States, and I'm not saying that it's perfect, okay, but in the United States, whistleblowers have protection. They don't always get the protection that they're afforded, but they do have protection here. It's not as scary as it's made out to be, that people come forward and use their name and use their face. When people want to make up garbage, especially in the mainstream, they say anonymous sources or an unnamed official or someone close to the family gave us this information. That's bogus. And it's happening here with a 30-year veteran of this industry, very respected gentleman, now coming out with garbage to the extent that William Thompson himself had to respond to it just to make sure that people are not being misinformed. And the whistleblower should not have to be chastising people for putting out false information about his story. His story is sensational enough. It doesn't need any finessing.
What do you think is actually happening in terms of American journalism nowadays? I mean, is it in the golden age? Is it in a dark age? Is it in a plateau? In terms of the quality of reporting that we're seeing out there?
Well, we have two things happening. We have citizen journalism rising, which means that people are reporting on things, putting things on YouTube. Anyone can get a website and start putting stuff up. That is an absolute wonderful thing. However, we are so far removed from what the press was originally intended to be, a checks and balances, where you gather evidence, you interview people, you gather information. You may have a theory, a running theory during the investigation, but you never let your theory take over the information that you're receiving, because if you're receiving information that doesn't fit your theory, you have to scratch your theory. So depending on what direction you want to take the article, you're gathering information. You have to let the information tell the story. You can't have a directed motive before you're going to sit down and write this article. But we have a large percentage of people who are just haphazardly putting information out there. They don't understand what it's about. They're not qualified to make a decision about whether or not this happened with the Foley beheading. Before it came out that it actually is a hoax, there was a lot of people coming out saying, it's a hoax, it's a hoax. I asked publicly for someone who has access to open source or otherwise facial recognition software, which is not that easy, not that hard to get a hold of. I don't know how to work it. I'm a journalist, but someone qualified to be able to look at the video, look at pictures of Foley, and break it down and use the software in order to see if this person really is the person in the video or if it's someone else. We can't just assume. We know that they fake things, wag the dog, and we get that. We know that that's true. But to just automatically assume that everything is BS degrades the fact that there's actual real things happening. And when we dismiss the fact that they're actually happening by saying it's a hoax or it's fake or it's a false flag, it's a dismissal tactic where, whatever, it's happening. But real people are dying. Real people are being affected. Real things are happening. There may be a portion of it that is fake and the rest of it is true. We don't know. And real qualified people need to come forward. And the best part about all of this is the millennial generation has grown up with the internet and programs and open source information for years now. And a lot of them are very proficient at what they do. They may not have been formally trained, but they have taught themselves how to use this great technology. These people need to come forward And maybe we need to set up a group of people who devote their time to actually debunking these things in a professional standard way, where there is maybe some sort of, for lack of a better term, scientific method applied to it, an industry standard method applied to deduce where the hoaxes are, what part of it is a hoax, so that we actually know where we're being lied to and where the truth is actually being eschewed, instead of just watching a bunch of YouTube videos that just say, oh, well, this is all fake because I looked it up on the internet. There's a lot of garbage on the internet. There's so much garbage on the internet that's insane. Anonymous sources, I don't even bat an eyelash. I don't care. You know what's real? There's an article circulating right now about Matt Drudge being an Israeli CIA agent. Now, I don't know if that's true, and nobody does. Why? Because the article that it's being quoted out of is coming from an anonymous source. Go figure, okay? Is Matt Drudge a neocon? Yes, he is. Just read his stuff. Go look at any interviews that he's done. See who he supports. Absolutely, he has those tendencies. However,
imagine for a moment that somebody is provably a murderer, provably a rapist, provably a pedophile, provably a fraudster, provably a psychopath, and provably a reptilian shapeshifting alien scumbag. All right? Now, do you approach with first, he's a reptilian alien shifting a scumbag? No? Why not? Oh, that's because people won't freaking believe it. All right? Put the stuff out there that's actually within people's grasp that you can easily prove. You don't need to talk about the in-depth stuff I've found a lot of the time. You just crack the surface open and the rock tips over and everything comes crawling out on its own.
Yes, and we also have to remember that factually based evidence is what we need to base our opinions on, our decisions. Think about it. If you go to jail, if you go to court because you're going to be sent to jail, you want factually based evidence to support your assertion. You want your attorney to get factually based evidence to do discovery to find out what the other side's facts are, and be able to counter them with facts themselves. You don't want haphazard people from YouTube just putting up videos and then the jury just says, well, you know, it's on YouTube, it said it was true, so it must be true. There are rules of evidence for jurors. Sometimes they can't, things are inadmissible even though it was said in court, it's stricken. People say, oh, well, you know, it's still in the mind of the juror. Yes, but there are rules of evidence. I'm not saying that this stuff is always applied properly, but they are there. As far as journalism goes, as far as news, as far as quality news goes, we have to demand from the news sources that we go to that they provide us with facts and evidence to back up their assertions. If they do not, or they cannot, or they will not, it is tabloid journalism. It's the Weekly World News, and take it for what it's worth.
Can I ask you as well, when it comes to this kind of journalism, in fact, this isn't a question. This is more of a statement. I was on a radio show this one time, and these guys were doing what you said, you know, tabloid journalism. They're saying, oh, well, this and that, blah, 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 because I said so. And I was like, well, guys, you know, there's kind of like these rules of evidence, you know, you got to have like three sources to verify it, you know, in the practice of journalism. And they go, oh, well, you know, tell us about journalism. The media is not doing any of that fact-checking, blah, 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 are they? And I go, well, you've made one principal assumption that is incorrect. And they go, yeah, what is it? That the mainstream media practices the journalism, you know. You know?
Exactly.
I mean, come on. Just because somebody claims they're a Christian and then destroys and kills and stuff like that and does everything that the Bible tells you shouldn't, doesn't mean that Christianity's bad, all right?
No, it just means the application of the religion is bad.
Yeah. I mean, dude, you ever seen anybody with a paintbrush that doesn't know how to use it trying to do a work of art? It looks terrible.
But then you see a Picasso or a Van Gogh and you say, wow, did that come from the same paintbrush?
Yeah. Like, if you see me working on a car versus my mate Dan working on a car, the one that I'm working on, I'll never run. Never. There's just no way. because some people can do certain things, and there's certain rules and ways that they go about it that they understand, and they just go ahead and they do it. They didn't get gifted with it straight away most of the time. They actually had to learn through experience. Training of some description in some cases. You know? You can't just take a camera, go out and be a journalist. That's why I still don't even claim to be a journalist. I mean, I'm just closer to simply being a douchebag with a microphone, you know? Comedian-like. That's about as closer to the truth than me claiming to be a journalist, because I haven't gone through the training. I often don't have a whole bunch of sources, but I'm not lying to you and saying to you that I know exactly 100% which is true and what isn't. And somebody says, you know, what I'm practicing is journalism, and I said, no, bro, I'm just being honest, all right? And that means honest enough to admit when you're wrong. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who claim to be journalists never admit when they're wrong, or print retractions as big as they print their main headlines.
Yes. And so my question is, if a 30-year-old veteran of independent journalism is caught putting out garbage under the guise of anonymous sources, how long has this been happening? How long have they been doing this? Are they trustworthy? Because when I write an article, I find sources. And if it's an anonymous source that I'm quoting out of a mainstream article, I make it very clear. The anonymous source, the unnamed source, allegedly claims, because it's an allegation. It's not a fact. And because this person refuses to give their name, they could be anybody or nobody. It could be a unicorn that ran in front of my house today. I was talking about that today on Facebook. The possibility of things is not what we should be looking at. It's the probability of something happening that we should be looking at. Yes, it's possible that a unicorn is going to run in front of my house, but what's the probability of that happening? Very low. So guess what? It's probably not true. It's just logic. And when you read an article in the news, you expect that you are receiving fact-based news. You trust, and that is where you're wrong. You should not trust the person on that website. You shouldn't trust me. You shouldn't trust any of us. You should click on our source links and make sure that we're telling you the truth. That's why I have at least 20 source links in an article. I want you to see what I saw when I was doing the research. I have nothing to hide, but I'm a minority amongst my peers. And I think that that's sad, because the tabloids have moved from the check stand to the internet. And no one can tell the difference, because anyone can have a website that looks awesome. And people think, well, you know, the website looks good, or lots of people go to it, it must be accurate and true. No, there's garbage coming out from both ends. And because people believe in the person who's telling them, because people put their trust and loyalty in that person without knowing that person personally, ever having dinner at their house, ever hanging out with them and the kids at the park, you assume that there's a new thing that's happening, and it's not just mainstream, it's happening in alternative. It's called native advertising. Have you ever heard of this?
Well, when the advertisers just, you know, go native?
I thought that at first, but what it is marketers for products come to places like BuzzFeed. And when I wrote this article, the senior public relations director at BuzzFeed emailed me within 2 hours of my article going live, which I thought I took as a compliment, because I never know who's reading my stuff. And I thought, wow, they're really on the ball. The reason why they responded to my article is because I was explaining how they are one of the kings of native advertising. And when I describe to you what this is, you've seen this in alternative media as well. We all have. We just didn't realize what we were seeing. So what native advertising is the editors at BuzzFeed and Forbes magazine, The Atlantic, several others, will get together with marketing directors, and they will write an article that denounces other things and then gives you the solution, which is the product that they're actually selling. It's a news article that is written just like a news article that is put together with other news articles amongst front page of the website or the categories where it falls under, and you wouldn't be able to tell. In fact, 50% of what's up on BuzzFeed are native advertising articles. These are infomercials, okay? They're telling you that this thing is bad or this thing is happening and you should buy this product because they're not doing that. And for legal purposes, right up at the top, right under the title of the website, like the Forbes magazine or the BuzzFeed, it'll say in little tiny font, sponsored by GE or sponsored by Mountain Dew. You would never look up there. You should look up there now. Or it'll say just at the beginning of the article, sponsored by GE or whoever. And the entire article is designed to get you to purchase the product. That's what they're selling you. And we see this all over the place. I've seen this even in alternative media, where the article looks like a news article, but it's actually selling you a product. Now, this is, to me, as a journalist, like the death of journalism. Because you can't, the articles are written so that you couldn't tell the difference between an authentic news article and a native advertising article. So you're already being marketed to under chicanery. And it seems to be okay with the people at BuzzFeed because they say, well, it's not that we're lying to our customers and our readers. It's that the editors are using their investigative journalist skills and tools along with marketing directors in order to better serve our customers. No, that's just a long-winded way of saying this company paid you X amount of money to write this article, and you're doing so, and you're marketing it just as if it were an actual news article, and it's selling your customers a product.
You know, there's been something said. I remember at the start of the segment, I'm sorry, Suzanne, we actually have to ramp it up now, something about dirty politics and the way they do it. Well, you know, look, I've had a look, Suzanne, at my kind of what I see as my competition in the New Zealand market. You know, the blogosphere, the YouTubers, and everything like that. The ones that are far more popular than me, who I guess I'm kind of jealous in a way. I'm prepared to admit it. Attach themselves to particular political leanings. You know, independent journalists really aren't supposed to do that. You know, push specific types of parties and actually be on the inside of them, that kind of thing, in order to maintain your independence. And on the other side, they're just shelling the public full of lies. And I'm sitting here watching the mainstream media lie to people, the left-wing blogs lie to people, and the right-wing blogs lie to people, and I see me telling the truth and me being the one that gets called the names and ignored. And that's journalism in a nutshell, isn't it? If you're an honest journalist. What was it that George Orwell said? He said, journalism is printing what they don't want you to print. Everything else is public relations.
I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, I was on Charlie McGrath's show. And we were in the midst of a conversation, and I ended up talking about this research paper for an article that I was going to write. However, I couldn't, and I'll explain why, about Tangy Tangerine. My husband and I went and looked up all of the ingredients on the label. They've since changed their labels. And went to PubMed and found scientific studies on the elements themselves. And if you want that study, you can email me at OccupyCorporatism@gmail.com. It's a PDF. I'll send it to you. I've been sending it to people for years. I could never write the article because of the pressure from my peer group not to write the article. So I have the information, you can have it, but I can't write the article because it's not just the government censoring, it's people in the industry censoring each other, because Tangy Tangerine is huge. And when I was on Charlie McGrath's show, within a week, Jones had the head of Youngevity on his show for like 45 minutes or to an hour, just describing and explaining why elements that are made that we make nuclear rods for our power plants are in Tangy Tangerine. Elements that are used in cat leukemia therapies are in Tangy Tangerine, not to mention heavy metals, arsenic, uranium. Not uranium, I'm sorry, but these heavy metals that you wouldn't take these things because it's in the vaccines and it's in the packaging and it's in the food. So why are you going to take it as a health supplement? It doesn't make any sense. And these things are cumulative. They build up in your body. You're not going to think in 30 years that all of those, you know, $50 canisters of Tangy Tangerine that you were taking is what's causing your cancer now.
No more than it occurred to Michael J. Fox why he's shaken so much after all those Pepsi endorsements.
Exactly. You're not going to think back that it was the Johnson & Johnson baby shampoo that has the parabens that caused your daughter to come to you at 42 and say, I have breast cancer. You're just not going to make that connection. But that's a strong possibility because parabens cause reproductive cancers, including ovarian cancer and breast cancer. In fact, when they do biopsies of breast tumors, they're 99% paraben. So it's not the BRCA1, BRCA2 gene, folks. Don't cut your boobs off. It's not.
Yeah. And speaking from the male perspective, I concur. And we'll be right. We will have to see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. And Suzanne Posel, thank you very much. Bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, this is a listener-supported broadcast. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. There is a number of ways you can contribute. I1, you can get yourself a blue shield, or you can check out our other sponsors like the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn there, or the Gourmet Soap Kitchen in Wagga Wagga. I love saying Wagga Wagga. Freaking awesome. Awesome place. And the other way, of course, is just the direct contributions to the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. If you're a Kiwi, there's actually a Kiwi bank in there, so you can just whip out, you know, set up an AP, $5 a month, $10 a month. It's actually really kind of needed right about now. And we will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening.